All my claims are that we have three fundamentally powerful forces that are software-driven, algorithm-driven, and energy-driven, which I think, well, that's the thesis of the show, I think these are going to effectively affect how we live.
Welcome to The Infinite Block, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of innovative technologies and policies on cities. I'm your host, Oliver Bruce, an angel investor based in Wellington, New Zealand, and I'm excited to have you here. Well, this is our first podcast in the Infinite Block series, and we have with us today Horace. How are you doing, Horace?
Hey, I'm doing great, thanks. Super excited. Yeah.
Awesome. Where are you calling in from today?
I'm actually in New Hampshire visiting family. I'm close enough to New England home here.
Awesome. Well, look, I'm really excited to be unpacking this new podcast concept with you. The core idea of Infinite Block is that it's a confluence of disruptive technologies and how they interact with how we live, work, and earn in cities. I think at this core, it's like we're thinking a lot about the social contract or the question of our social contract in rapidly changing times, you know, and that the contracts we make with each other and also with our governments. And so my aim for this podcast is that we explore both the tech and how it'll impact the cities in which we live. But I certainly think that it's just, we're going to start talking to a lot of really interesting people about what they're thinking and building in this space as well. And really this kind of comes out of your and I journey into micromobility. In a very practical example of the things that we're thinking about, you know, it's like we started talking about electric bikes and scooters and other small vehicles. And yet when you think about that, you end up thinking about how do you connect them to the internet? How do you incentivize and build out wireless networks? And then on the other side, it's like, well, how do you then think about, you know, you've got these small little new units of transport and how do they move themselves to a city? And then you start getting into street space allocation, which falls you backwards into urbanism. And then you start thinking about rezoning and how do we work out how to build better data systems that allow for cities to be able to see the rise of these new vehicles and then be able to build infrastructure for them. And then when they're making those decisions, how do they get better data and effectively surface intelligence that allows them to do street space reallocation and shift it away from this process that takes a really long time at the moment to something that's a lot quicker and hopefully better. And then how do we think about financing them and all these sort of things? So, I mean, it's really all of those things tied together because we started with micromobility and I think in some ways that kind of hamstrung us a little bit. So the idea is being able to use a kind of a wider framing, the infinite block, to be able to think about how all of these different things interact. And I think the name of the infinite block is that it's representative both of the block, the city block, the smallest geometric unit that we plan our cities around, and things like blocks of code and the blockchain. And certainly I'm unapologetic about believing that the blockchain is one of the most fundamental advances in human tech in the last 100 years or so. It enables us to build and maintain new social contracts in ways that we've not really thought about before, or certainly like I think we're going to see a lot of stuff that starts to merge in ways that we haven't been able to do that. And yet at the same time, cities are some of our oldest and most resilient institutions and inventions. They are sort of anti-fragile and they both go in and out of fashion, but they very rarely disappear. So I kind of wanted to bring you on, Horace, to be, as our first guest in this discussion before we go off and talk to others as well, mainly because I think, one, you have such a great grounding in the historical perspective, especially around cities. And then also as well that you know, you're just a world-class expert on disruptive innovation. And so I thought, you know, there are folks who do know you. This might be a new podcast for folks who don't necessarily know you. Why don't we start there and say a little bit of yourself and then let's get into the city discussion and why it matters.
Just quickly, I'm going to say that I spent a couple of years working with Clayton Christensen before, and I did that as a senior researcher or fellow in a think tank that he founded. Prior to that, I was a student of his in business school. And so I had known him already for 20 years prior to working with him. But ever since, he made a great impression on me when I was in business school and he was teaching us. And he seemed to have this crazy idea that you could actually create a theory about business, and at least one that tries to define a subset of the causality of success and failure. Clearly not all of the causality because it's a multi-causal system, but that was a courageous thing to say in the mid 90s. But let me frame it also the question that you're asking as far as the subject matter here about the city and the block. And what I've been struggling with through our journey through micromobility is that the path of micromobility runs through the city. It runs through it because it's the natural habitat of micromobility. And so in some ways, you might say that, you know, it was chicken and egg. Does the city encourage new modes of transport, or the new modes encourage the city to transform itself?
Mm-hmm. Or both,
exactly. It's interesting when you study cities and mobility is infrastructures, and ask yourself, what is the relationship between people and infrastructures? What are the cycle times for innovation in each of these? There's a lot of arguments back and forth about, you know, what's more important. Is infrastructure more important? Is city government more important in making for better life for the citizen? And I've been going about this over and over again, and it's like this fascinating circling around the problem. And one thing that I wanted to point out is this block idea. One of the things about blockchain is, like, you know, things that are public and things that are private, and the notion that a permanence of record, the transaction is made permanent through its attachment. Now, when we think about our lives, we have private lives and we have public lives. When we think of our housing and our transportation, we also have private circumstances and public circumstances. So you can't separate the fact that your home, even though it's a private space, has a relationship with the street, and the street is itself a public space, and the street links permanently your physical space with other people's physical space. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that, you know, effectively a home is something on the block and on the street, and therefore it is there forever. It cannot be moved. You can move in and out of it, but the point is that there's this sense of permanence about cities. There's another thing about cities that's fascinating, is that they do tend not to collapse. They tend to continue. There have been a few periods of city or urban collapses. These have been coupled usually with civilizational collapse. So as long as you have civilization, two examples, by the way, would be the great late Bronze Age civilization collapse, which, you know, extinguished a bunch of cities, and then the Roman period, which ended with some collapses, although not as many, and probably have as many cities, or I should say as many cities as existed then exist now, but there was sort of a contraction, let's put it that way. My point, though, is that the city has an interesting permanence to it. It's also a dynamic place, and so we should think about it in those dimensions. Now, having said that, you know, one of the tenets of micromobility is that cities always win. Cities are permanent. Cities always grow. And we are an urban civilization. We are actually growing to be, as a species, 75% will be urban citizens. But I want to bring up one point that maybe people would question this thesis. The United States, Canada, perhaps Australia, New Zealand as well, people in these societies tend to live more in suburbs. And they tend to, you know, probably people who listen to us today are most likely to be living in a suburb, and they don't think of themselves as urban citizens. They think of themselves as kind of suburban citizens, and that's somehow different. But let me put it to you this way, and I've watched something that was very provocative. It's this theory of strong towns. But basically, the assertion is that the suburban concept is bankrupt. Mm. The suburban concept is not only unsustainable, but it actually is predictable when it would begin to fail. And it has to do with infrastructures. It has to do with the road networks that bind it all together. And that itself was created because of the automobile as the vehicle type that enabled the suburb and therefore created the infrastructures. And here's a very quick argument of why that is. The way infrastructures tend to be developed for suburbia is that there's an artificial plan. It's not based on some natural resource or some reason to cohabit a particular place. It's more like this tract of land that we're going to develop. We're going to put single family housing on it. We're going to lay down pipes for infrastructure, and we're going to put down paving for roads. And we're going to build these low density housing. This will be done in batches. So it's not one at a time, but rather, you know, hundreds at a time. And then the developer pays for that, sells the units at a profit, and the city then begins to collect tax on this, some of which is used to maintain the infrastructure, but most of the money comes and maintains the city overall. And, and so the town grows, and the more it grows, the more these new families that are living there are contributing with taxes. And these are property taxes, which are based on property values. Now, that infrastructure that was put in by the developer, usually at their cost, the developer paid for it. The city did not pay to build a road. The developer paid, and that money that is sunk comes with an expiration date. And that expiration date is 20, 30 years or so, because that roadway and those pipes in the ground and wiring that needs to be set up, you know, none of those are permanent, and they do have a sort of a replacement date. And when that bill comes, there's not enough money that, you know, the city isn't going to now take all the property tax and put it away for a rainy day for 30 years from now. We're going to need to rebuild everything. No, it's spent. And usually there's not much, you know, in fact, there's a lot of debt, in fact, by the time you say we have to replace everything. So the entire problem is, from a solvency point of view, from the infrastructure as an asset point of view, is that that asset becomes quite a liability. And so you have a problem with the suburban model, that it defers and does not write these debts down as something on its balance sheets. So whenever you study business, you want to look for invisible liabilities or liabilities that are not recorded. And if you looked at the way people live and ask what cities have these liabilities that are invisible and what cities possibly have assets that are invisible, the suburban model comes out as a very, very big net negative. You know, it doesn't work because also there's some basic geometry issues here. One household, which is going to have 3 to 5 people, let's say, is given X number of meters of roadway, X number of meters of plumbing or sewage or electrical. And that is very expensive to begin with. And then when you replace it, it's, you know, the estimates are, because there are cities that are going through this right now, the estimates are about 1 year's worth of income for that family. So if your income is, let's say, $100,000, you have a liability for that property that's unwritten for about $100,000 that needs to renew its lease.
It's amazing how you end up as a public finance nerd if you start studying all this stuff.
Exactly. I'm only scratching the surface.
I know. And yet I think that intersection, right, of going like public finance seems like something that's so irrelevant, and how do we think about structures of finance, et cetera. And yet it very clearly interfaces here with like, well, why can't we build bike lanes? Because the cost of moving all of these things is very expensive. And you go, oh, you know, this is fascinating.
This anomaly, or this interesting observation, which is a financial one, or sort of like, okay, not particularly interesting. Okay, so we have some imbalance, I mean, we have some unrecognized liabilities. Mm. And then you put these down and say, well, that's interesting, or that's peculiar. But then you start to add up the scope of the problem. You start to also ask, you know, because there's a lot of absurdities about building suburbs in the first place. There's a lot of absurdities about living in that configuration when you try alternatives, and then you also see how the rest of the world works. And you say, well, that's very strange that the zoning laws and the exclusionary and the road and all these other weird irrationality, if you will, of this setup. And people just shrug and say, well, that's the way it is. By the way, it's been going on for 80 years or whatever, or 70 years. But I'm here to say only that actually, first of all, that configuration is probably only for about 5% of the world. It's not for 95% today. And I don't think that those 95 are going to switch to this particular configuration. It's not something that if you gave someone a clean sheet of paper and say, how would you like to build your city, they would follow these rules anymore. And many cities that are old are kind of not able to go there. And new cities may not want to go there. And then you look at the numbers and you say, well, actually, things don't quite add up. And then you say, okay, that's a 5% configuration. But for the 95%, a lot of people who are yet to be joining the urban communities, they're right now just moving into various configurations that are somewhat random, not very well planned, which is actually probably smart, because you want to have an organic structure, right? That's historically the case. But again, you go down the causal chain and you say, well, the reason the US is this way, or the North American experiment is this way, is because a lot of it has to do with the car, and that has to do with the roads that the car needs. And then that's where you stop and say, wow, okay, so it was enabled by a technology which is called the automobile. But nowadays we have alternative technologies, which are non-automobiles. They're still personal. They're still based on individual freedom. but they're not that particular configuration, which would mean that presumably we're going to have a new configuration for cities as we move forward into an electric vehicle era that is not automotive. That's the thesis of micromobility. I don't have to repeat that. But the question also is that another technology that's coming into play is AR and visualizations of the physical world, which are layered with abstractions, which are layered with information. And on top of that, we also have this notion of new ways of defining risk, which is Web3, defining relationships and defining control, which is decentralized. And that means that suddenly these kind of converging, so micromobility, augmented reality plus blockchain or Web3, they're all coming together in ways that we cannot anticipate how they'll change the way we live together.
Totally. And
so I think that's our thesis right now, is that these are interlinked. And I'm not saying that, you know, I think micromobility is an enabling technology for urban configurations, but so are other technologies that are just emerging now.
If you talk about all these things as well, I think there's a really interesting intersection there that happens between cities themselves are the epicenters of, you know, economics, culture, and science and that sort of thing. But a lot of that stuff isn't necessarily going to be tied to a city. It has traditionally been tied to a city. But actually, that if you can, for example, think about being able to interact on the internet and be able to build a community of people that you can trust and interact with, it traditionally would have been the role of a city, or would have taken the role of a city to be able to facilitate that interaction. Then what is the role of a city in that new place? And I'd really love, you know, Horace, our society of cities are going to decide this sort of like economic and environmental fate of the planet in some ways, right? Like, and yet what we're seeing, and you have alluded to this, we have people in power, public authorities, et cetera, the sort of the central decision makers that oftentimes we think of in our cities, haven't really been able to keep up with a lot of the technological developments that we've been seeing. Would that be a correct assessment of your view in terms of how we think about, so, you know, like the rise of this and the interface?
It's not just leadership that's behind the curve here. I think all of us are going to be behind the curve to some degree because things are moving so rapidly. I'm only going to be able to expose to you a few absurdities or a few anomalies or a few things that when you step back and say, wait a minute, this makes no sense at all. How did we end up in this world, which is upside down or in many ways, you know, front to back? Or there are things which under different circumstances would be complete opposite. Okay, let me walk through some of these absurdities. One is that we have cities now which are growing to be tens of millions of people. Okay, mm-hmm. That's a mega city, that's 10 million people. And they're probably going to be looking at 40 to 50 of these places. Some of them are agglomerations, which means there are multiple jurisdictions, if you can imagine that. And so that means that a city suddenly becomes bigger than many countries in terms of population. And that already we have many cities that are wealthier than many countries, and yet they have very limited power to effectively govern beside the most local basic needs like education, transportation. Those are within the domains of these supposedly, you know, lowest people in the stack of power. The stack of power being, let's say, local, regional, and federal or national level. So if you say, well, the mayor has a very little power compared to the president. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the opposite. The mayor has the most power because that fundamental question of like what people care about most will be determined by local. You know, this is why this Think Global, Act Local. Yep. Mayors are actually potentially going to have constituencies that are as big as major nations, not to mention GDPs that are as big, if not bigger than most nations, not to mention that if an association of mayors in a country like the United States probably will have a greater GDP than those who are not in that association, right? In terms of the overall economic value created in their constituencies. So that's one interesting point, okay? Right now, people will shrug and say, that's interesting, so what? Again, you have concepts that are bankrupt, which are suburbs potentially. You have concepts about political power, which are upside down. You also have concepts of efficiency, as we talk about a lot in micromobility, about decisions being made about allocating resources to infrastructures, which are backwards. And this all sounds very much like disruption theory, because what you're saying is that, you know, the low end, the bottom of the stack, is actually much more powerful and has the ability to drive much more change and innovation than the top of the most demanding, the most wealthy, and so on. So there's this David and Goliath effect. And so when you ask about blockchain and what can this do to rectify this, you can perpetuate an imbalance indefinitely. It can stay lopsided, it can stay upside down, it can stay chaotic forever. What usually causes a system to change, though, is that it gets injected with something that is the catalyst for change. And that typically is a technological thing that mostly is a toy. It's inconsequential, but suddenly it triggers, like a catalyst does. It triggers a reaction that accelerates in the opposite direction. So what are we looking at? This is why we're excited about this, right? We have miniature vehicles. We have electrification, and thus a lot of power in a little space, a lot of power that's portable, a lot of power that is becomes fabric, as opposed to just points on the map. You know, the whole idea of electric drive is about distributing power from, even in the sense of the liquids themselves that are used as fuels, you have central refineries, central points of extraction, you have central points of distribution, and then you have places to fuel, and everything is lending itself to a centralization. The fossil fuel system is a centralized system. Electrification is a decentralized system by nature. So you're seeing this already as an effect, right? The distribution of power itself, the packetization of power, the fact that a battery is a packet. I don't need to again belabor this. This is micromobility theory. But what I'm saying is that on top of that, you layer. So you have one strike against the rigidity of the current system, but then you have another one coming with blockchain. And the ability there fundamentally is not just decentralized power, but the ability to actually unlock, because through risk and risk taking and the ability to wager, the ability to put skin in the game and thus demonstrate the superiority of an idea. That's fundamental to this whole logic. Superiority of an idea, and suddenly eyes are opened. What blockchain can do is inspire people and communicate information and signal what is right and what is wrong. A lot of that comes through a method that we don't just use words. We don't just use, listen to me because I have authority. Listen to me because I have some brand value. No, it's going to be done in an algorithmic fashion with many players voting effectively for the outcome that is best. And that is a political force. And if you put that into, you know, sprinkle that in as well, you have yet another potential for dramatic change in a rapid way. All I do as an observer is say, hang on a second, there's a lot of weirdness here, things which are not right, which are going to flip. I don't know when, I don't even know how, but I can also see things that could cause that flip to happen sooner and faster. And then finally, we had the third notion, which is AR, which is really more like a displays or how information is finally brought to the user. And you could argue that the smartphone, what's the big deal about it? Well, a smartphone is just a display in your pocket. Well, display in your pocket turned out to be very important. It was a toy, but now it changed the world because social media allowed people to have voices that didn't have otherwise. There's good and bad in that, but it changed the world. And there's no question that was a catalyst for change. So now we have that moving into much more of a wearable than the pocketable, and that will have implications. That's all I'm saying. All my claims are that we have three fundamentally powerful forces that are software-driven, algorithm-driven, and energy-driven, which I think that's the thesis of the show. I think these are going to effectively affect how we live in the physical world as well as the virtual one.
Forgive me, listeners, if this sounds like we're still kind of grasping at straws a little bit here. I think there's certainly a part of it that we certainly feel as we've been kind of conceiving of this has been that what we feel like is that there's a lot of stuff that's just about to come. In the same way that we felt like when we were looking at micromobility in the very early days, and for folks who were around when we were putting on that show, it was like, it was a very, you know, in some ways we had just seen the rise of electric scooters, but it was just so super nascent at the time. But we could see that there was all those primitives were there to come together into this new way of the beginning of the Cambrian explosion that is micromobility. If I think about it like you, Horace, I mean, it's all of those things. All the primitives are there. And it really starts to go, well, we have had long traditions of ways of doing things until now, that if those things come to fruition, if those primitives actually grow and they become better, oftentimes ways of doing things, how does that really change? How does that interact with what we have today?
You know, as a proponent, advocate, whatever, analyst, whatever you want to call me, of technologies, would be that, you know, we've seen these enablers coming into phones, we've seen them coming into entertainment, we've seen them coming into mobility with micromobility, we've seen all these things, and we know how transformative they are. But let me look at it from the point of view of those who are frustrated, who have long been in city government, who have long been in city policy, who have long been in trying to make change happen. And I have heard them speak, I have heard their anguish, and they're saying, look, we understand the world is upside down. It's inequitable. It's wrong in many ways. It's unfair. And yet, you know, they're super frustrated because all they have is voices. All they have is words. All they have is data and arguments, but they aren't moving the needle with those things. It's not enough to simply state that or calculate that things are wrong. You know, society doesn't move on argument. Society doesn't move on debate. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge of a disruptor is an innovator who makes change happen. The argument is that, no, we have to give things to people, products, typically services, yes, that they run with. And then they become, through the use of new things, they become like, oh, wow, this actually is better. So, mm-hmm. you know, and you can say the same thing about, let's not forget that the automobile replaced the railroad, and the railroad was the source of one of the robber barons. I mean, we're effectively people who profited from this. Sometimes, you know, unfairly, there were imbalances in transportation as a result of it. Of course, a lot of wealth was created and value was created as well. But democratizing transportation is what automobiles were all about. You know, mm-hmm. we ended up distributing the problem of transporting people to effectively one person, one machine. The problem is after that, we ran for a century with that, and we ended up with something which is inequitable in a different direction, but it's going to change inevitably. And with that mode came with a way of living, and came some constructs of city and government and taxation and policy and everything else, which, again, I think are up for a renewal. So all I think we're saying is that, and again, I took the point of view of those people who are in the trenches who are suffering about this. You know, their points of view are like, okay, if only we could do more advocacy, if only we could just get a paragraph in the next 1,000-page regulation, or totally. Only they mentioned, you know, cycling should be this and that at COP26. We talked about this, and if only like could get in front of the right people and make our case. The fact is, it's going to change from, not to say not to do those things, but don't expect rapid change. Don't expect, you know, the kind of change that shakes the foundations to come from a well-reasoned argument. I think the argument of the technology is what's exciting here. And suddenly we're seeing these things potentially emergent and potentially converging and potentially enabling the kind of change we've all been dreaming of for decades. We're not here saying we came up with this need for change. The need for change has, you know, pre-existed for decades. There's a lot of things wrong here. Our job is to simply talk about catalysts, talk about enablers, talk about timing, and talk about scale, and talk about who first and who second, sequencing. All of these are the practical issues. Now, you did say we're being very vague, but we're more than zero in some ways, right? We're moving forward a little bit.
Exactly. And to give, you know, I don't want to get prescriptive. I really don't with who we're thinking of bringing on the show. But as a heads up, you know, these are the sort of things that we're thinking about, which is that we're thinking about, how do we platformize city functions so that they can capture innovation and change? What does democracy start to look like in Web3? Or like what the idea of an internet of value? Like how do we unlock intelligence from all over society to be able to contribute to the better solutions for how we make decisions as a group. How do things change in terms of earning capacity, the disconnect between earning capacity and local economy? So what happens with the rise of digital nomads into cities? What are those cities focus on? How does that change things if your earning is decoupled from your geography? Mm. And then the builders, the people who are building prefab housing or looking at new ways of zoning cities and or like building new cities. What does a cloud city start to look like? You know, all of these sort of things I think are all ripe for our discussion in this space.
And one of the things that I don't want to be sort of the iconoclastic here and sort of polemical or anything like that, but the fact is that a lot of the arguments saying, well, change cannot happen or change cannot happen quickly, or this is multi-generational, or that there's so much capital invested in this upside down world and so on. And so I hear this all the time. We've heard it on the micromobility side of things for a long time. How do you expect to change the highway system or even the local road system when all of that investment has gone in? And I always answer to this, that these are sunk costs. They are enormous, but if they're in the wrong direction and somebody proposes a better way of doing things, we will simply forget that we spent the money. We'll spend the next incremental dollar on the new system. And this is why the fallacy of sunk costs is that you begin to decide based on having already committed to the wrong path for so long that you shouldn't change paths. I think most people will eventually, and I think the pioneers out there, the innovators, the risk takers will say, well, we can actually start on a new path and we don't have to think about the old ways. And I think that's one of the things that with crypto is that we have the potential to actually deploy a lot of capital, deploy a lot of intellect, deploy a lot of energy to a new direction. We have this ethos of the community, which says basically, we are all very happy to start with clean sheets of paper and build new constructs and build new organizations, build new communities, first virtually, but then I think that'll leak into physical very quickly. And then for those folks, we say, okay, if you have this energy, if you have this capital, if you have this commitment, here's some solutions. We can configure things fairly quickly in this direction. That's the magic here. When I was starting out in the cellular world, people said we can't expect the landline world to roll over. We can't expect the PC world to roll over to the smartphone world. Many people argue there would never be enough bandwidth to put 6 billion people on mobile internet. All these arguments were quantitative, were based on, you know, install base, were based on invested dollars. And I heard all the naysayers, and they were frankly very convincing because the numbers, they knew they had all the data, they had all the numbers. And today we have all the data and all the numbers about current infrastructure, current cities, current communities. And nobody wants to say, oh, well, what does it mean if every suburb in America declares bankruptcy? If some aren't even allowed to do so, by the way, they're just not legally allowed to, which means passing the buck to someone else. And that causes states to go bankrupt. And there's so much, and people would say that, but that's catastrophic, that's cataclysmic. But then again, that's just sunk costs. You've been making wrong bets for a long time. You're going to have to pay for them at some point. And so to provide, the answer isn't to panic, but the answer is to say, look, there's alternatives. Actually, they're a lot cheaper than you think. They're a lot quicker than you think. And they're a lot smarter and better in every way. So why don't you just stop bitching and moaning and get on with the job? So there's ways to do this and not have civilizational collapse. So yes. What everyone I think assumes.
Totally. Well, I think one of these ones, right? Like if you watch what's going on with climate change and you think about the amount of division that we have in society and like, I think that the prospect of civilizational collapse is something. I don't want to get all, you know, nihilistic about this, but you know, it's hard to see how our current system of governance and structures and the way that we do things adapts to this new world and this new reality of how quickly things are going to have to move if we're serious about trying to solve climate change and we're doing all these other things. And so, in some part, right, like, why I'm also interested in the show and trying to do this is to say, what are the tools? What are the things that we're going to be able to do that allow us to bring people along on this journey? Well, you're right when you say that the existing ones that we've had to date, it's about transcending those, right? Like building the thing that's better than those that allows us to go to the next phase.
So the thesis is this, Do not be afraid of sunk costs. Do not let the past determine the future. Because you've made mistakes in the past, it doesn't mean you need to make mistakes in the future. So it's a very basic thing. It's an illusion. That's why it's called a fallacy. That's why it's a dilemma in general. It's human nature to mourn for things that have passed and so on. But we're here not to do that. We're here to actually point the way forward and say that there are better ways of doing things. And human ingenuity is limitless. Human creativity is limitless. And now we actually have amazing new tools that are developed by brilliant people that allow us to actually figure this out. And I think that the great thing about my observation of it, at least, is that over the last 20 years, we've had wave after wave after wave of innovations that are just incredibly, and they built on each other, right? And incredibly powerful. And we mustn't forget that now we have more computing power than we could imagine was possible. We have more computing and power in our own pockets. We have more access to information with the internet. We have more access to encryption and sensing and visual.
I was going to say, not only information, I think that the point that kind of blows me away is like, there is going to be in the next 3 to 5 years, the ability for anybody to earn money anywhere there is the internet connection in ways that like, it's quite significant and quite surprising ways, I think.
It's the fact that intellect itself and dedication or commitment or all the things that are virtues can be applied without the need for physical connection with someone else, without the need for having some kind of bloodline or, you know, like the old ways.
Oh,
like,
100%.
The binding of people to the place is no longer, you know, serfdom and all of that other stuff that was like over the centuries, we've moved away from more and more control. Some regression obviously occurs, but so it's an optimistic idea, but I, you know, without just being a pie in the sky here, we're trying to be much more specific and with you know, a set of tools and set of ideas and a lot of sharing of information about what's working, what doesn't work. And that's our modus operandi. But I think that's the thesis here. So my assumption is that we're looking at a 5-year horizon, nothing more. We're looking at least 3 enablers. We might be looking at more.
Yeah.
And the target of this energy, this innovation is actually the city, or in a broader sense, the community, or in the way we decide to live and the way we decide to organize ourselves at the bottom of what is a political hierarchy, but yet the most powerful in the long term base is at this layer. And that would allow us to reorganize society. And it's maybe a little utopian, but I think it's very likely that it will actually happen. The first time that we can even talk about the fact that these innovations going all the way back to Moore's law and microprocessing leads all the way to the fact that, wow, we can actually rearrange the way politics, the way society. Mm-hmm. Let me just pause for a moment to give you this perspective, because when I was talking to Clay, and I started with my bio, a little biography there. When I was talking to Clay Christensen, I was asking these fundamental questions. Well, can this theory help us solve some serious problems? And this is, we're talking like 2015, so 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And what sort of big problems do you think? So he was very interested in healthcare. He was very interested in education, healthcare, because he was himself often had health issues, but also, and so he had great visibility to the system. He also saw, as an educator, he saw fundamental problems with education. And I suggested at the time, I said, look, we need to look at energy. Energy is something I think we need to absolutely deal with. And that meant transportation as well, but energy was a big, big piece of it. In retrospect, what we were afraid to touch were these political questions.
Yeah.
We were afraid to touch the question, well, should we really be thinking that government itself is probably up for disruption? And by the way, the undercurrent of all this, like, yes, education will get disrupted. Healthcare will get disrupted. Energy will get disrupted. And indeed, some of it is from external forces that compel you to get to change, but others are from, you know, like bottom up of forces, which is what disruption is. It's like it's going to get eaten up by something else, an alternative that comes from nowhere that you ignore. You know, that's the classic disruption. And yet no one would suggest in 2015 that government could somehow itself. And what government means in this disruptive sense? Well, it's not the federal. It's not the international. You got to keep going down all the way to the bottom. And this is how, if there is a change in the fiber of society, as far as governance is concerned, it's going to start at the bottom. And what is there? The city. Boom. That's where we are.
Totally. And it's also fascinating if we go back to like societal trust what are the things that people trust in society? People have a higher trust of Amazon and Google and Apple than they do of their, for example, Congress or oftentimes of their political processes. And it's not saying that you necessarily will see that emerge as well. I certainly think there's a shifting in society of what are the services that deliver for what we need, right?
One other little anecdote, which is like, I kept getting over and over again, listening to Clay Christensen said, you know, he's really always came back to this virtue of humility. And I, you know, he kept saying things like, you know, it takes a lot of courage to be humble. It takes a lot of confidence to be humble and this and that. And it was like, okay, well, that's nice. These are nice aphorisms. But when I started to think deeply about disruption theory, what it really says at the heart is that it is humility as a business model. So fundamentally, what disruption requires, it cannot exist without humility, that those who disrupt must say, I'm not really interested in that big stuff. I'm okay down here. I'm happy with these customers who are not paying a lot of money for my product, and I'm not going to try to do the best in the world, you know, or anything up at the top. And the idea is that, like, I'm fine, you know, in my humble little place, but then you just keep nailing it and killing it. And then you eventually, like, you are on top of the heap, but you didn't get there because you aimed there. You just got there because you took one step at a time. So the point of it is that as far as cities, and you were to talk to people in city government, if you are to talk to people at that level in there, they're so busy trying to solve local problems that they're not, you know, saying, well, you know, don't ask me about federal problems. Don't ask me about state problems. I'm just trying to make sure people are satisfied at this local level. Well, that's exactly the way good businesses are run. Good businesses care about their customer first, and then don't worry about strategy or all of those other things supposedly that are important long-term. They're like, but because of that local focus is that you end up actually owning everything. And I think the opportunity here is that the technologies and the systems that are being built would allow this fluidity to happen, this ability, this liquidity of power. I don't know if that's a term that people use, but power being liquid is something that means it translates from local to federal. And right now we're stratified. Right now we're compartmentalized. It's not liquid. It's not like if you are the mayor of 10 million people that that translates into anything in terms of a federal power, but that might happen. And I don't know what the consequences will be, but hopefully, you know, we can cope.
Totally. And I actually, one of the other episodes that I'm really excited to be doing is talking about the rise of city states and like that one, their ability to be humble, but more nimble and ability to serve. And also as well, that's historically how things have been. You know, you look at the rise of during the Renaissance, it was all largely city states.
It was all city states. Absolutely.
All city states. And I think we'll, you know, Nassim Taleb talks a lot about it in Anti-Fragile and Skin of the Game. The most kind of logical organizing system for a group of people was actually a city state.
And the theory here is that when you are solving the problems at the local level with government that is strictly solving the most practical problems, how, I don't know, but it's possible to imagine that we're going to see this pyramid inverted and that the federal is not necessarily, in the US, by the way, it's a peculiar system where the states have a lot of power. Right. So the U.S. is more like central. There's a heavy weight in the middle. And so the top and bottom are fairly lightweight. In Europe, it's much more hierarchical. And maybe, you know, in a city state, it's inverted. So like in Singapore, it's probably inverted. So this is the question about where does the weight move and shift as technology? This is the key here. Technology can enable a shift in these systems. And it's peculiar to think that it comes via transportation, which I think it's funny because transportation seems also to be the Achilles heel, which may cause a societal crisis as we're seeing. And so pay attention to these things, pay attention to the weird outliers, the anomalies, the exceptions. And that good theory comes from analyzing those as opposed to averaging things. Oh, sure. On average, you know, it looks like it's top down. So
there's clearly a lot to cover. And certainly from my perspective, I think this is an incredibly exciting time. We're kind of still figuring out where all of this is taking us in terms of innovation and disruption, et cetera. And I want to kind of also frame up as well that we certainly don't feel like we have all the answers here. But what we want to do is talk to people who might and find out all we can. And so, yeah, the way that this will work is we're going to be releasing a kind of a lively mix of thinkers on a regular basis who are building the tech, the companies, the projects, et cetera, focused on harnessing tech to drive the next generation of cities forward. But in the meantime, please reach out to both of us on Twitter. And the aim is that in the future, we want to be able to do a conference on this as well. That is certainly the aim from our side, that we can bring together people who are thinking about all of these things and put them all in the same space together and have that be a kind of veritable fest of excitement and certainly very interesting things. Look, thank you, Horace. It's so good to have you on and to hear your thought and work out, like to be able to riff a little bit on where we've kind of got to in our discussion around what the future of cities will look like.
Of course. Great. Thanks for inviting me.
Not at all. Looking forward to more future conversations.